As much of the Lone Star State reopens, many prisoners in Texas eligible for parole are remaining behind bars. Why the holdup? The story today on the Texas Standard.
Texas Standard is a production of KUT Austin, KERA North Texas, Houston Public Media, and Texas Public Radio in San Antonio, with support from Rand Group, software delivered as promised. No surprises.
I'm David Brown. The governor says officials are monitoring the state for possible flare-ups and outbreaks, but that effort's overlooking many parts of Texas, notably communities of color. We'll have details. Also, Texas hospitals that receive bailout cash are suing a growing number of poor or unemployed patients and rethinking the mythology surrounding the Texas Ranger, the week in politics, and a whole lot more when the Friday edition of the Texas Standard gets started. And that happens right after this. No matter where you are, it's Texas Standard time on this 29th day of May, the last Friday of the month. You made it. Hope it's been a good Friday so far. Let's get right down to what's making headlines, shall we? Play ball. So says the latest proclamation from Governor Greg Abbott, which will allow fans to attend sporting events starting today everywhere in Texas. Wait a minute, did I say everywhere? Almost. And for popular teams, it may be especially hard to get tickets. Intrigued yet? We'll get details from Alex Samuels of the Texas Tribune when we check in with her on the week that was in Texas politics a bit later in the big broadcast. One other thing of note from the governor's office since we last spoke, an extension of the early voting period this fall. In an interview with KCBD in Lubbock, the governor said that he'll do for November what he's already done for July, namely offer more time for voters to go to the polls in the interest of shorter lines and more social distancing. He didn't say how much of an extension there'll be in the fall, but we already know early voting for the July runoffs will begin June 29th. Stay tuned. As we've been learning, in a world turned upside down by the coronavirus, past assumptions aren't always very useful. Take, for example, the assumption that people in prison, once paroled, will get out. As investigative reporter Lauren McGaughey writes for the Dallas Morning News, that's not happening for many. Lauren, welcome back to the Texas Standard.
Thanks for having me, David.
So do we know why these prisoners who've been granted parole already aren't being released?
Yes. So in Texas, it's very common when you're granted parole to be required to finish some kind of a reentry, life skills or drug abuse program before you're actually freed. And that's common. But now that coronavirus is in the state jails and prisons, these inmates feel like it would be much safer for them to complete those courses on the outside instead of sitting in their cells doing workbooks and potentially being exposed to the virus.
Let me just understand what's going on here. So once granted parole, I thought that that was it. Does the state have the authority to hold back someone because they haven't completed a bit of coursework or something along those lines?
That's right. So the parole board, the Texas Board of Pardons and Paroles, looks at each individual offender who's completed at least half of their sentence and decides whether they want to release that person early. But 3 out of 4 people that are granted parole early are required to take some kind of coursework. Sometimes the coursework is required because they are in there for some kind of a drug abuse or offense, so they have to take some kind of a substance abuse program. But oftentimes they're just required to complete a course that's like a life skills course, a general reentry program. And these inmates say, why can't they do that on the outside instead of inside their cells where, you know, maybe someone down the hall or some guard is coming in and they might be exposed to a sick person.
So this is effectively a kind of outbreak prolonging, I guess, right?
Yes. So the Texas Department of Criminal Justice has confirmed that there are some inmates who have been granted parole on condition they complete a course, but they can't even begin their coursework yet. Oftentimes people have to wait weeks or months anyway to start those courses, but the coronavirus has stopped inter-prison transfers. So many people would have to be transferred to another prison to even start their coursework. But because the coronavirus has halted those transfers, they can't even begin the program that they need to complete to get out.
I see. So what is what are critics of this saying? I mean, I think I can imagine.
So there have been other states that have taken it upon themselves to release more inmates early in an effort to stop the spread of the coronavirus. The federal government has also done the same thing. About 3,000 inmates have been granted home confinement early release by the U.S. Bureau of Prisons. Uh-huh. But here in Texas, the politicians have resisted calls to release anyone early, saying that it could be a public safety hazard to begin releasing people en masse. The folks that believe that these prisoners who have been paroled should just be let out say, well, they've already had their case looked at. The parole board has already decided to release them anyway. So why not just, you know, let them complete that programming that they're being asked to do in their home for the 3 or 6 or 9 months it might take them to complete it?
Well, what's the scope of outbreaks of COVID-19 in Texas prisons right now?
So right now, there in total, there have been almost 4,000 inmates who have been infected with the coronavirus to date since the beginning. And currently, 2,700 inmates roughly are in isolation because they are sick and contagious with the virus. There have been 43 confirmed deaths in the Texas prison system. This is guards, correctional officers, employees, and inmates. So, you know, both the staff and inmates are being hit by this coronavirus.
There are many more details to this story. Read all about it in the Dallas Morning News. We'll link to it at texasstandard.org. Lauren McGahey is an investigative reporter based in Austin, where she covers criminal justice for the Dallas Morning News. Lauren, thanks again.
Thanks, David.
So far, there's been more than 873,000 COVID tests administered in Texas. That's according to state health officials. As the coronavirus continues to spread, there have been calls for more tests. But now that supply has started to catch up with demand, in fact, exceeded in some places, the question becomes, how can someone get access to a test? A joint investigation between NPR and our partner station, KERA in North Texas, looked at testing site locations to see if there was a pattern. Brett Jaspers joins us now. He's a politics reporter with KERA. Brett, thanks for speaking with The Standard.
Thanks for having me.
All right, so when we're referring to testing site locations, the ones that you counted and tracked, are we talking about a specific kind of testing location or any testing site?
No, a specific kind of testing locations. You know, these are sites, we looked at sites open to the public and advertising that fact. So it's not places where you need to be a patient already. That's the case with some hospitals and doctor's offices that are right. doing testing. But we didn't include those because you have to be a patient already. The other ones we also didn't look at were mobile testing sites, which might be traveling around to different places. Uh-huh. These are, like I said, places open to the public and, you know, come one, come all.
Got it. Okay, so how many cities did you survey in Texas, and what did you find?
Well, the 6 largest cities we looked at, and in 4 of those cities, we found that there was a significantly more testing locations were in whiter areas of those cities than in places with more higher concentrations of people of color. And those 4 cities that had this issue were Dallas, Austin, El Paso, and Fort Worth. The 2 cities that did not have this issue with this disparity in testing locations were Houston and San Antonio.
In the places where testing sites were often in neighborhoods with greater concentration of white residents than people of color, any idea as to why?
Well, yeah, when I talked to the Dallas County Health and Human Services Director, Dr. Philip Wong, he pointed out when I showed him the list, he's like, you know, a lot of these are private healthcare providers. And so that points to this larger issue of just healthcare access and doctor's offices and hospitals and places to get healthcare being located in whiter areas, which might also more typically have paying customers who have insurance. And so those areas are just better served by the overall healthcare system. And so this is somewhat of an extension of that. You know, urgent care clinics are more likely to be in these northern, at least in terms of Dallas, North Dallas neighborhoods. And so, you know, a lot of those are the ones that are offering COVID-19 tests.
What about reactions to this investigation? I understand that on Thursday, you visited a new testing site in South Dallas. Is that right?
Right. Well, the community, this this testing site in South Dallas wasn't necessarily a reaction to our investigation. They had been working for a while to raise money to also open up a free come one, come all testing location in a South Dallas church. And that started on Thursday, and they're going to roll out 5 more locations over the coming weeks so that eventually there will be a different church hosting a free testing site every day of the work week. And so yesterday I went to Friendship West Baptist Church, is the inaugural location for these testing efforts, and I talked to Frederick Haynes, who's the senior pastor there.
And so we said, let's use our trusted institutions. The most trusted institution in the Black community is the Black church. And so that is why we've gotten together. And so we have set it up where Black churches are now hosting sites for this opportunity to test. And
so what it sounds like is they're going to try to fill that breach. But what are public officials saying?
Well, Philip Wong at the Dallas County Health Department, he says, you know, every time we do have input on where a testing site goes, be it because it's federally funded or, you know, a partner reaches out to them to ask for their help, they try to put testing locations in neighborhoods in South Dallas that have less access to healthcare. So they're trying. And, you know, Pastor Haynes said, you know, the county has done a good things, but it's just not enough. And also people just feel more comfortable with their church. So it's, you know, the different people at different levels are trying to address this problem.
Brett Jaspers is political reporter at KERA. Brett, thanks.
You're welcome.
Social media editor Wells Dunbar joins us now. Hello there, Wells.
Hello, David. Unrest in Minneapolis, the talk of Texas, videos of protests, riots, and even a police station set ablaze, all circulating on social media after the police custody death of Houston native George Floyd. Let's get to the reactions via Facebook. Marcus writes, I'm not sure why everyone is justifying destroying the livelihood of people in the community, property, or even the police station. But Matt Weiss counters that these are the extreme measures that happen when all other avenues are ignored. How many Black men and women need to be murdered in police custody for this to end? Matt adds that authorities will let some white alt-right nut job with an assault rifle scream in their face for the right to go get their hair cut, but unarmed Black men are being choked, shot, and beaten regularly. For another take on social media, let's shift to President Trump, who took to Twitter to post in part that when the looting starts, the shooting starts. Twitter allowed that tweet to stay up, but with a disclaimer that it violated Twitter rules about glorifying violence. Hearing reaction to that and other stories today, David, I'll be back with more later in the program.
In about 35 minutes, to be exact, we'd love to hear from you, Texas. Tweet us at Texas Standard.
Support for Texas Standard comes from Texas A&M University, dedicated to providing clear and scientifically vetted information about COVID-19. Texas A&M articles and reports about this global pandemic are available at fearlessfront.com.
I am Elizabeth Bunn, but everybody calls me Ellie. I've been I am a high school senior at Paschal in Fort Worth, Texas. I was actually at the hospital when the lockdown was announced because my sister had just had her baby. And so that was kind of crazy because we decided to social distance from them just to, you know, keep things safe. But I guess senior year really started changing once they extended spring break. At the end of that, I was really missing my friends. I was really missing class. And then they announced online school, and that was just kind of crazy because I was wondering, you know, what's going to happen with prom and with big band dance, which is something our jazz band does. It's like super classy, and like swing dancing. I wondered about graduation and about AP testing. And then all of my college auditions were moved online. I didn't get to tour any of the campuses that I'm looking at, which was a huge bummer because I was kind of relying on that to be my deciding factor between the two that I'm choosing between. But yeah, I think not being able to do my auditions in person might have maybe messed it up for me just a little bit because I think I would have delivered a better performance. But you know, the lockdown happened for everybody, so we're all at an equal shot now anyway. But my sister Hannah lives overseas, and my sister Sarah lives in Oklahoma. But because of the border closing and because of, you know, the lockdown, my sisters are now here. And so is my grandma, to see my other sister's new baby. That was a lot of sisters, sorry. Basically, the silver lining is we have 6 people in a 2-bedroom apartment, and it's kind of crazy, but I did miss them all. And so it's really nice for us to spend this time together, because we're kind of at that age where, you know, we would never probably live together again. So I don't know. I think that's been a pretty cool thing. I really do think that this has showed me the importance of community. You know, like a lot of kids in high school, they feel so alone, and they're like surrounded by all these people. They're surrounded by classrooms of kids and teachers who care about them. And if they're in fine arts, like obviously that's a major community, sports, any of it. And I've always valued that, but I don't think I appreciated it enough. Like being away for so long now, I'm really, really sad that it's my senior year, that this is like how I'm ending it. You know, there's still summer, and these people will still be here when Corona isn't. I know people who are getting together after this and like throwing mini proms or just having a lot of parties, like a lot of pool parties once everything is cleared and everything is safe. Okay, not being dangerous. So I think I'm just gonna try this summer to really spend a lot of time with these people. I'm Ellie Bunn, a graduating senior at Pascal High School, and you are listening to the Texas Standard.
Support for coverage of business comes from Texas Mutual Insurance Company, providing community relief actions for the COVID-19 crisis, including early dividend distribution to eligible policyholders. More at texasmutual.com/dividends.
And you are listening to the Texas Standard. Texas Congressman Joaquin Castro and Lloyd Doggett are asking the U.S. Department of Agriculture to stop working with a San Antonio business that's been tapped to distribute food to food banks. The wedding planner Create a Date, which is spelled out like a license plate, CR8AD8, is one of several companies awarded tens of millions of dollars by the USDA to help feed families in need. Texas Public Radio's Paul Flav reports the company's being criticized for its lack of experience with large-scale food distribution.
The $1.2 billion Farmers to Families Food Box program was created in lightning speed because, as the USDA's Christopher Purdy said, the situation was desperate.
Most of you are living and breathing the tough situation right now. Farmers dumping fresh produce and milk, euthanizing animals in some cases.
At the same time, food banks across the country have been feeding unprecedented numbers. So the USDA, with a couple hundred contracts, tried to rewire the food distribution system to get them more food quickly. But 2 weeks in, San Antonio Food Bank CEO Eric Cooper says they're only seeing a fraction of the promised food.
We just haven't seen the volume that we were anticipating. And, you know, part of that is the largest contract in kind of the Southwest region went to a company called Create a Date. You know, they weren't on our radar.
That's because San Antonio-based Create a Date, which at nearly $40 million got the 7th largest contract in the country, is a little-known wedding and event planning company. When the contract was awarded, it had no warehouse, no trucks, no license to move produce, no experience, and its address is a mailbox at a UPS store. Yet, it somehow convinced the USDA it could deliver 750,000 food boxes across the Southwest in 6 weeks.
I worry that USDA, they might have been catfished, right? People are reaching out to me going, hey, are you spending time, energy, and effort pursuing something that isn't real?
Create a Date declined to speak to TPR for this story, and USDA declined to answer questions about Create a Date's contract. The Farmers to Families program has already voided one contract with an inexperienced California vendor, and there's concern about several others.
I guess I would say it doesn't surprise me too much.
Jennifer Ahern is a policy director at Citizens for Responsibility and Ethics in Washington. She says the USDA may have moved too fast and prioritized the wrong things, weighing the company's narrative over its history and its financial ability to deliver.
it seems like if you are prioritizing those other things over somebody's ability to deliver, that's exactly the kind of circumstance that's going to lead to a situation where you may have some folks who receive contracts who aren't able to deliver on them.
Nando Gonzalez walks down a narrow aisle of crowded produce at River City Produce. It's cold inside the temperature-regulated San Antonio warehouse.
You have jalapenos, you have Texas green beans right here, you have limes that came from Mexico.
He bid the USDA contract for a fraction of the $39.1 million given to Create a Date. Didn't get it. He's fine with that, but when he saw that it was a company no one had ever heard of, he and many others were shocked.
Disbelief, shock, saying, surely this is a mistake. When it's an entity that isn't even in the industry, the flags start going up. How does that happen? Because these things that you're looking at took years and years and years of infrastructure to build.
River City has around 50 trucks and has 75,000 square feet of warehouse space.
How much time does it take a company like yours to spend $40 million?
It takes a while.
It would take longer than 4 weeks, he says. That's all the time Create a Date has left. It's told food banks it will start June 1. All the nearly 40 food banks across the Southwest need it to be successful. Eric Cooper said he's rooting for Create a Date, but they also don't know what to expect. I'm Paul Flav in San Antonio.
A Texas firebrand conservative in the House, Chip Roy of Austin, has teamed up with the Minnesota Democrat and fellow freshman Dean Phillips to push through a measure to ease up rules for COVID-19-related small business emergency loans. Among the things this new bill includes, allowing businesses to defer payroll taxes and extending the time that business owners have to use the loans through the end of the year. Next stop, the Senate, and we will, of course, keep you posted.
From the Texas Newsroom, I'm Joseph Leahy. Texas zoos and water parks can begin welcoming visitors starting today under Governor Greg Abbott's phased plan to reopen businesses amid the coronavirus pandemic. The venues are allowed to operate at 25% capacity. The same goes for outdoor motorsports events. On Sunday, other professional sports groups can begin hosting outdoor events with spectators, also limited to a quarter capacity. Indoor pro sports events can resume without fans attending. The members of a Christian social justice organization are calling on the federal government to drop an eminent domain lawsuit against a Catholic orphanage in South Texas. The Trump administration last month sued the 100-year-old Sacred Heart Children's Home in Laredo in order to survey the land for a potential border wall. The Reverend Nathan Empsall is with Faithful America, which delivered a petition this week to U.S. Attorney General William Barr, U.S. Attorney Ryan Patrick, and Acting Customs and Border Protection Commissioner Mark Morgan.
We've seen the administration target a number of churches and religious institutions for several years now to take their land for the border wall, which really suggests that everything the president says about defending religious freedom is simply not true.
More than 18,000 people have signed the petition. Anger over the deaths of black men and women in encounters with police is expected to lead to more protests in cities across the nation this weekend. At a community forum in Midland, Texas last night, residents expressed concern over the way police treated a 21-year-old black man who was pulled over earlier this month after his car ran a stop sign. Several officers with their guns drawn surrounded Ty Anders. Cell phone video of the incident, including a moment when Anders' grandmother fell to the ground, has gone viral. Midland resident Claudia Skinner spoke at last night's forum. She said that Anders
had his hands up, was on the ground, crying and pleading out of fear. This man was facing a felony charge over allegedly running a stop sign. How is that fair?
No shots were fired, and Anders was charged with evading arrest. U.S. Senator Ted Cruz is requesting the U.S. Justice and Treasury Departments investigate Twitter for allegedly violating sanctions against Iran. In a letter to department heads today, the Texas Republican cites the social media company for allowing Iran's supreme leader and foreign minister to maintain Twitter accounts. He argues that violates U.S. sanctions prohibiting American companies from providing goods or services to top Iranian leaders. I'm Joseph Leahy for the Texas Standard.
Support for these Texas headlines comes from Bite-Away, a chemical-free treatment alternative to instantly relieve the itch and pain caused by insect bites. Portable, reusable, and no mess. Suitable for children. Learn more at TakeTheBiteAway.com.
33 minutes past the hour, Texas Standard Time. I'm David Brown. Lots of businesses are hurting right now as the economic fallout from the coronavirus continues. And that includes healthcare systems, as revenue-generating elective surgeries were temporarily stopped. But for some hospitals, a break in the form of CARES Act payouts is helping buoy their lost income. And we're hearing that at least one hospital chain is looking for income in other ways, including a hospital chain that got a payout from the feds. They're taking poor patients to court over unpaid bills, even as unemployment remains high. This is something that Jenny Deem has been reporting on for the Houston Chronicle, where she's an investigative reporter focusing on the healthcare system. Jenny, welcome back to the Texas Standard.
Thank you for having me.
You open your story with an anecdote about a Cedar Park woman named Cheryl Billings. What was her situation?
Cheryl was is a 64-year-old woman. She's disabled. She lives on $700 a month in SSI, and she was sued for back payments to the hospital, overdue medical bills. And she, when I spoke with her, she could not even recall the hospitalization. She wasn't even sure what it was about. And as she told the lawyer when she went to court in February, that there was no way that she would be able to pay the thousands of dollars that she owed. And the lawyer told her, not my problem.
Is it clear just how widespread these suits are? I mean, you cite a study in your reporting called Eroding the Public Trust that examined these sort of hospital lawsuits, right?
Yes, there was over a two-year period, there were over 1,000 lawsuits filed by 28 hospitals in 62 counties, in total for almost $18 million in medical debts. And but what was fascinating about the study was that this was a concentration of not very many hospitals, but there was one particular hospital chain. It's a for-profit chain out of Tennessee that sued people the most, and that's called Community Health Services.
And it's also my understanding that a lot of these lawsuits are coming from one particular law firm in Dallas?
Yes, 83% of these lawsuits are being generated out of one law firm in Dallas, the Deloney Law Group.
A lot of these incidents which led to the Billings and ultimately to the lawsuits, these have been stretching out for years in many cases, though, right?
Correct. There is a four-year statute of limitations where you can sue somebody for a bad debt, and a lot of them are just now coming, you know, winding up in court that go back a couple of years. But what was one of the things that was striking is the researchers told me that they were curious to see what was happening in the pandemic. And it turns out that there were over 300 lawsuits filed against patients just in March and April. So this trend is continuing even as hundreds of thousands of Texans are losing their job, losing their health benefits, and, you know, are financially strapped.
But hospitals need revenue to operate. How much of their operating costs do these unpaid bills account for?
Well, and that's the other thing that's troubling, is that these lawsuits do not represent even 1%. I believe the figure was 0.15% of their overall revenues. So this isn't making up for lost revenue. It's not helping the hospitals that much, but it is devastating the patients, many of whom, like Cheryl, are, you know, very low income. Perhaps they're now unemployed. And in some cases, they simply didn't even know what was happening. They there were incidences where patients tried to find out from the hospitals and the law group, you know, exactly what was the bill? What was, you know, what was this all about? And they couldn't get any information.
In the few seconds we have left, what's the recourse for people who've been hit with these suits?
Well, I think the thing that you need to do is you need to ask for an itemized bill. You need to contact the hospital and say that you want to make sure that you're being billed correctly. There are often errors in bills. And if it is all correct and you do owe money, you also need to talk to a hospital's financial team, see if you can get on a payment program. If you have insurance, contact your insurance company to see if they will advocate for you. And I think also it's always a good idea to try to get a lawyer. Sometimes just a letter from a lawyer will resolve this.
Jenny Deem is an investigative reporter covering healthcare for the Houston Chronicle. We'll link to her latest over at texasstandard.org. Jenny, thanks for your time.
Thank you.
Support for Texas Standard comes from Rand Group, partnering with SAP to help mid-sized companies streamline operations such as CRM, finance, and procurement. More at randgroup.com. Software delivered as promised. No surprises.
It's the Texas Standard. I'm David Brown. As far as living memory stretches, many Texas kids hearing the tales of the Texas Rangers have longed to grow up and earn the right to wear the badge. From fights on the frontier, the hunt for Bonnie and Clyde, and beyond, few figures loom as large as the Texas Ranger. And no, we're not talking about the baseball team, clearly, but that team name in itself speaks to the legend. But as Texas Monthly put it recently, decades of myth-making are upended in a new book re-examining the history of the Texas Rangers in a way you won't find in most museums. The book is titled Cult of Glory. Doug J. Swanson is the author. Mr. Swanson, welcome to the Texas Standard.
Hi, David. Thanks. Great to be here.
As I understand it, you spent some time here in Texas during your period of education. When did you first hear the tales of the Texas Rangers? Do you recall?
Oh, I think I was a kid growing up in Florida. There was a wonderful World of Disney show that had something about the Rangers, and I remember seeing that. So that's my first memory.
Yeah, I think it is for a lot of people. Yeah, absolutely. Or hearing stories told by parents and grandparents. I mean, for a lot of Texas kids. Within the first few pages of the book, though, you write that the Rangers, and I want to quote here, not only have they covered up their wrongdoing, they and their willing accomplices have perfected the art of mythic rehabilitation and resurrection. Are you speaking in the present tense there, or are you talking about something that has gone on for a while?
Oh, I think it's gone on for a while. That was one of the surprises to me as I started researching the book more than 5 years ago, that there has been this myth-making that has gone on. And, you know, of course, we all understand that myth-making happens, but there were many stories that underlie the myth and belie the myth that make it a far more interesting tale and far richer.
But cult, of course, in the title, it sounds like a pejorative. Where did you enter into wanting to retell this story of the Texas Rangers?
I started looking at some of the old legends, and I'm an old investigative reporter. I worked at the Dallas Morning News for 34 years, and I tried to bring an investigative reporter's approach to it. I started peeling back the layers a little bit, and it was surprising to me how fast some of these old legends just fell apart. They weren't true, or there were, as I say, far richer stories underneath them.
Well, give us an example of one of the stories that didn't hold up under your scrutiny.
Well, there's a ranger, a former ranger named James Callahan, who's buried in the Texas State Cemetery. And on his tombstone in the Texas State Cemetery, it says he chased Indians into Mexico in 1855. And that's true as far as it goes. And that's what the legend is. And Callahan County in West Texas is named for him. But the fact is, he was on a mission to recover runaway slaves. and bring them back into Texas and sell them. And his mission fell apart very quickly. He had to burn down the town of Piedras Negras on the border across from Eagle Pass to escape. So his mission was nefarious, and it was a complete failure. But none of that makes its way into the initial legend.
For some historians and scholars from the border region in particular, you talk about Americo Paredes. This isn't exactly news for them, but perhaps we should focus for just a moment for those who don't know the story, right?
Yeah, the Rangers were notorious along the border in the early part of the 20th century for being what we now term death squads. I mean, they had a list of people they were out to kill. Mexican-Americans, Mexicans, Tejanos. Some of them were bad guys. A lot of them were just innocent people. And, you know, depending on your source, the Rangers killed anywhere from several hundred to several thousand Mexican-Americans or Mexicans or Tejanos along the border in the early days of the 20th century.
To many, though, those stories, among others, aren't really part of official history, and there have been other books that have highlighted the early atrocities of the Texas Rangers, too. But what I'm wondering is, when in official state-sanctioned museums and history books, there's no mention of this sort of thing, when do certain misdeeds become part of history as you see it?
Well, I guess it depends on who's writing the history. As you say, that many of these atrocities have been written about before, but they were not part of the officially sanctioned history, as you say. You won't find these sorts of things in the Texas Rangers Hall of Fame and Museum in Waco, for example. Up until recently, you wouldn't find much of a mention of it in the Bullitt Museum of Texas history, although a few years ago, they did put together a really nice exhibit on atrocities along the border. So maybe this is turning a little bit. My point is that a lot of this has been out there. A lot of this is in the records, but it's not what is emphasized in what we might call the official history.
I can't think of the Texas Rangers without thinking of one of the heroes of the Texas Tower shooting, who himself was of Mexican-American descent. And I recall when I talked with him at the time, he said that he always longed to be a Texas Ranger, and that was what he was most proud of. I think about the many other Texas Rangers who've been honored in the line of duty and the many Texas Rangers who have fallen, more than 120 in all. And I wonder what you would say to those who believe that, okay, there maybe the myth has been overblown, but is it possible that this reconsideration or reconstruction of history does a disservice to what the Texas Rangers have evolved into today?
Oh, I don't think it does a disservice because I mention quite frequently the heroic actions of many Rangers. I mean, you're right. There are many, many, many Rangers who were brave and tough and did what had to be done. And there were many dedicated Rangers who did the right thing all along. There's no doubt about that, and I write about that. There were many who lost their lives in the line of duty showing extraordinary courage. No doubt about that. But, as I said, it's a far richer, more fascinating history if you dig down into the layers and talk about what else happened. That, to me, is the most interesting part. But don't get me wrong. The many Rangers were heroic, brave, dedicated, upright. And I've worked with a number of Rangers when I was a reporter at the Dallas Morning News. I have nothing but good things to say about them. So that's part of the story, too, and I try to cover that as well.
So how does the myth of the Texas Rangers match up to what the organization is today? It's part of DPS, of course, and there were a lot of reforms instituted back in the mid-30s to turn them into the investigative unit that, by and large, they are today.
Yeah, and they are a much more professional force now. They have much more training than they used to. You know, the Rangers of old were very independent. They didn't have a whole lot of training. They were picked because maybe they were good riders horse riders, or could shoot well, or were just in the right circumstance. Now it's a professional law enforcement agency with, as I say, a lot of training and high standards. So it's much different now.
Doug Swanson is the author of a new book titled Cult of Glory. It's all about the undisclosed and perhaps less known history of the Texas Rangers, as well as what the Rangers organization has evolved into. Mr. Swanson, thanks so much for taking a few minutes out to talk with us on the Texas Standard. We certainly do appreciate it.
Oh, my pleasure. Thank you.
We're fast approaching 49 minutes past the hour at Texas Standard Time. We're going to take a look at the week that was in Texas politics next as the Texas Standard continues.
Support for Texas Standard comes from the Texas ABLE program, a tax advantage savings program helping eligible Texans with disabilities save for the future. Learn more, including how the program works with certain public benefits, at texasable.org.
I'm Jody Edgerton with Typewriter Rodeo. We create custom poems on vintage typewriters. You give us a word, a phrase, anything you like, and we create a poem for you on the spot. We're in this together. We knead dough. We sew masks. We hide in the shower. We take deep breaths. We clean floors. We stock produce. We titrate drips. We relieve suffering. We deliver the mail. We teach virtual kindergarten. We deliver wine. We process claims. We drive buses. We bag groceries. We wave at neighbors. We walk the dog. We steal a few minutes of solitude amidst the ever-expanding household chaos. We grasp at connection and moments of shared laughter, shared stories, new memories. We are, all of us, together, even as we stay apart. I'm Jody Edgerton with Typewriter Rodeo, and you're listening to Texas Standard.
Support for the Typewriter Rodeo comes from Texas Children's Hospital, focused on outcomes and care, and providing treatment to kids in the Lone Star State and beyond for more than 60 years. Texas Children's Hospital, personalized care for every child. More at texaschildrens.org.
That poem comes to us from our friends at Typewriter Rodeo. You got a suggestion? Let us know. Send us your poem-inspiring idea on social media or email us texasstandard@kut.org. No week would be complete without checking in first with Alex Samuels. She's the Texas Tribune's politics reporter with a week that was in Texas politics. Alex, welcome back.
Happy to be back.
All right, Governor Greg Abbott was in Amarillo this week, a place hit hard by the coronavirus, as lots of our listeners know. Many cases appear to be linked to area meatpacking plants. So what did the governor have to say? Anything particularly new?
Right. So as you mentioned, there was a flare-up in Amarillo. And in response, the federal government sent a strike force there in early May. And then the governor sent what he called surge response teams there about 3 weeks ago. And due to those dual efforts, the governor said Wednesday that the number of new cases in the area has been on the decline.
In fact, just yesterday, we were hearing that the numbers of coronavirus cases have spiked statewide after a recent decline in many parts of the state, which apparently led the governor to take steps toward a return to sports, as I understand it. But I suppose we should point out there are some important caveats here, right?
Right. So as you mentioned, starting Friday, most counties will be able to host in-person spectators for outdoor sports in venues as long as visitors are capped at 25% capacity. And as you mentioned, this announcement is an expansion of the governor's more recent wave of economic openings that he announced on, I believe, May 22nd.
Not everyone's going to get to play ball, right? There's several counties that are sort of carved out. They will not be able to have sports.
Right. So Deaf Smith, El Paso, Moore, Potter, and Randall counties are excluded from the governor's proclamation because they've all been identified as coronavirus hotspots or places with aggressive flare-ups.
And there are several other asterisks here. First of all, this order does not cover high school sports or college sports. I guess there will be more on that score, if you'll pardon the pun, a little bit later on in the year. But there's something else, too. To actually have a league participating in sports, as I understand it, you first have to get the green light from officials.
Yeah, so leagues will have to first apply to and then receive approval from the Texas Department of State Health Services. And another caveat is that fans are still banned from attending indoor sporting events in person.
Okay. So got to be aware of all of those special qualifications here. Mm-hmm. You know, there's been a big conversation about the possibility of Republicans coming to Texas. At least that was part of the talk of Texas earlier in the week when President Trump threatened to maybe pull out of North Carolina and move it to some other state like Florida or the Lone Star State. Texas Democrats are going to be kicking off their state convention, but it's not going to be like any other in the past, as I understand it.
Yeah, so Texas Democrats will kick off their convention next week, but it will be held virtually due to the coronavirus pandemic. This is, of course, different from the state's Republican Party, who will hold their convention in person in July in Houston.
And as I understand it, they're going to have a high-profile speaker at that Democratic state convention.
Right. So Joe Biden is expected to close out the convention, or he will close out the convention, I should say. I believe next Saturday is when he'll be giving his speech, but the full schedule should be coming out today. And of course, we have so many other high-profile Democrats, Nancy Pelosi, Julian Castro, Elizabeth Warren, Beto O'Rourke. They will all be speakers at the convention as well.
You want more details? Go over to texastribune.org. That's where Alex Samuels is, political reporter. Alex, good to talk with you again, and have a great weekend.
Thank you. You too.
And you are listening to the Texas Standard. Joining us once again, it's our social media editor, Wells Dunbar. Hello there, Wells.
Hello, David. Good to talk to you this Friday.
Good to talk to you, sir.
Well, as we mentioned, yes, the story out of Minneapolis still tearing up across social media. Really some provocative images and videos coming out of there last night. This fire, this blaze engulfing a police station. All this after the police custody death of a Houston native, George Floyd. We've reported on him in the show this week. I mentioned this earlier, President Trump getting in some hot water on Twitter with the mods there. He posted a two-part tweet. The part of which read that, quote, "When the looting starts, the shooting starts." As I mentioned, Twitter allowed that tweet to stay up, albeit with a disclaimer that it violated the rules on the service about glorifying violence. Via Twitter, we have folks weighing in on the company's decision. James Richards tweets that he stands on the side of Twitter in this one. It's their platform. They own it. And Ben Saylors basically agrees with that sentiment, saying, "I think this is how all tech companies like YouTube, Twitter, and Facebook should handle stuff like this. Cover it up with a disclaimer, explain why it's covered, but allow people to opt in to proceed." And indeed, that is how the tweet appears. It basically has this disclaimer saying it violates the terms of service, but you can click through to read what the president wrote.
You know, but this is a sticky situation for social media platforms, because they've always maintained that they are neutral observers, that they stand on the sidelines, and that's what makes them different from publishers. And they've been able to protect themselves from liability and other claims because of that stance. Now, once they start weighing in, saying, find out the facts, and, you know, this violates the terms of service, it begins to become an issue. And in fact, this is something that President Trump has taken with that executive order that he signed just yesterday.
Yeah, definitely. And lots of discussion over that executive order, just what it exactly does, as it is an order and not an act of law. But yeah, lots of discussion about that. And social media really just being the place where it plays out entirely. One of the friend and listener of the program, Bear Philippe, he tweets that he was keeping an eye on everything last night, and he was following what he calls the independent sources on the ground for the protests across the nation, citing out one Twitter account. I believe it's Unicorn Riot is the name, and they have been an invaluable resource. And I tell you, I was watching their live stream last night of the police station go up in flames. Very, very once in a lifetime historical stuff unfolding there in Minneapolis.
You can keep up with all the news over at texasstandard.org. We're out of time for the big broadcast, but we hope you'll join us again on Monday. Till then, I'm David Brown, along with the rest of the Texas Standard crew, wishing you a wonderful weekend.
Philanthropic support for Texas Standard comes from Casey and Scott O'Hare, the Winkler Family Foundation, Lynn Dobson and Greg Waldridge, Adrian Killam, and the George Huntington Family. Would your company or organization like to be a sponsor as well? Contact your local station for opportunities within your community. For statewide sponsorships, visit TexasPublicMediaNetwork.com.